Hey guys, are you in a band in Austin? You're looking to make the leap from band of schmoes to full-on pros? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. Listen, they are selling gift certificates. So if you know a band that needs some help, a band of schmoes that needs to be transformed into pros, buy them a gift certificate. Call them at 512-448-9518 or go to spaceatx.com. Space, rehearsal and recording. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you today. Today, producer, label owner, and now manager of bands, Chris Frenchie Smith returns. He's a fantastic dude. He owns Frenchie Smith Records. He owns the recording studio The Bubble. He was in 16 Deluxe and Young Heart Attack. He has worked with produced records for The Trail of Dead, The Toadies, The Boxing Lesson, Leopold and His Fiction, Scorpion Child, Dandy Warhols, The Darkness. He is a force to be reckoned with and a fantastic dude to sit down and talk to. And we have a great conversation about tons of stuff, man. We even get into the people putting out records now. How are they doing it? U2 versus the Foo Fighters. Which one's cooler? Which one was weird? I think you know what the answer is, but we talk about it. Anyway, Frenchie and I have been friends for about 23 years now. We started out working at Whole Foods together. If you want to listen to episode 179 before you listen to this one, go on back and listen to it. You can hear the first conversation we had where Frenchie tells his whole story. This one, we just basically catch up and talk about what he's working on, and now he's taken on co-managing a band called Purple that he produced. And things are happening. They got a record coming out soon, and we talk all about that stuff. So you will enjoy my fantastic conversation with the amazingly entertaining and always colorful Chris Frenchie Smith. I'm sorry, my chair is shrinking. Anyway, great conversation. That's what we got going on. What's going on with me? I've had a busy week, and I did not really talk to you guys on the Tuesday show. The shows have been running a little bit behind because I've had some cancellations, and they kind of came at a time when I didn't have any shows already done. So I've been kind of like scrambling, getting some interviews together, and so I did some this week. They were great. But last weekend, I played with Skyrocket in Fredericksburg, and I was going to go to this Congress House 33-year anniversary party. The guy that interviewed me, Mark Hallman, in the last episode, is the owner of that studio, and I've known him since I was 13. And when I was driving back from Fredericksburg, I found out that the party was kind of over, but I was misinformed. The party was still going on, just the person I talked to was leaving. So anyway, missed the party, but the next day I went and I played my friend Jason's wedding, and Jason Mazursky. He plays with Ben Harper. Ben Harper was there at the wedding. He got up and jammed on a song, but I was not on stage with him, and I did not meet him. Although I will say this, from afar and from maybe, I don't know where I was to him, maybe 20 feet at one point, very handsome. Very handsome man, and healthy looking, and he sang very well. He sang Helpless by Neil Young. The party was great. I sang a weird song with that band of people. My friend Kyle assembled. This guy with this crazy kind of mane of curly hair and these glasses. He's kind of interesting looking guy. Anyway, I did The Kid Is Hot Tonight by Loverboy, which was weird. And my friend Darren jumped up on stage and started singing those harmonies on it, if you know the song, and really made the song come to life, because I don't think I could have handled it on my own. I wasn't wearing a headband. I was not wearing my red leather pants. And so I was basically gonna die up there. The next morning, I drove back. That was in San Antonio. I drove back the next day and in the morning got up and I went and recorded again with Kimmy Rhodes for her album on the last session. We did a big band session. I sang another duet with her. It's fantastic, man. I've had such a great experience. I wish I could go into studios every day. Everybody's super pro. Donnie Wynn, Glenn Fukunaga, Bradley this engineer, Gabriel Rhodes, her son, is producing it and also playing on it. Kimmy's totally pro. And it's totally like an old school session. Like, we're the session guys. And we're sitting around, and she comes out and goes, like, here's the song. They hand out a chart so you can kind of look at it. And she plays the song, sits down, plays you the song and sings it. And you kind of go through it with your eyes, make the notes that you need to make, and kind of figure out how what you're going to do in just a couple of minutes. And then they roll the tape. No click. Donnie Wynn just counts it off, and you play. Amazing. What a vibe, man. Glenn Fukunaga, what a gigantic pro. I got to play a tenor guitar for the first time. I'd never played one. And Gabriel had to teach me the chords. And thank God it was just a three-chord song. So I just learned three chords real fast and then cut the song, and it was fantastic. I had a great time doing that. I love working with Kimmy. And rehearsed with Skyrocket, and then we played a show out at Steiner Ranch again. And man, that crowd just keeps getting stranger and stranger. There's a guy we call Sexual Grandpa out there. He's a wacky dude, man. He's out there. He does his signature dance where he squats down and then he grabs his back like he heard it. Like, he squats down and he points like at a certain lady that he wants to see, be like, hey, we're dancing. Whatever that engaging thing you do when you dance, you give someone the eye or the face or whatever. I don't do it. I think it's weird. Anyway, Sexual Grandpa gets out there and he does his move and then he squats down and then he grabs his back like he heard it. And it's always the same. It's a signature move. He acts like he heard it. He makes his face. He goes like, ooh. And then he stands up real slow. And then he starts dancing again, like grooves back into it. A few weeks ago, I caught him smoking a J out behind a bush. And our Benjamin in our band, Skyrocket, when he came to the gig the other night, he told me he's caught him again. He's out there before the show. So that explains the weird dancing. The guy's high as hell. And he's out there trying to dance. And God knows what, you know, what he's thinking. And he's pretty old. And he doesn't go for like obscenely young women, but like sometimes women like get into it and start dancing, and then he gets a little more serious, and then the girls go like, oh, I was just kidding, you know, like that kind of vibe. You can see it from the stage. You can watch it happen. I see a lot of stuff like that happen. It's always weird. This gig that we played in Fredericksburg last Saturday, there's tons of like bachelorette parties that go to these things. Literally like four different bachelorette parties. There was a bachelorette party that was really having a good time, and then another bachelorette party moved in with like a very mean girl in their party that started kind of messing with the main bachelorette of another party. It was real sad and very, very mean. It was a mean girl. Anyway, so Skyrocket played Thursday at Steiner Ranch, and I got to see Sexual Grandpa do his dance, signature move. Love it. And then Friday night we were off, but we had a party, which we don't. Like, nowadays, we don't really all hang out together outside of work. And we went to our singer, Trish, just got a new place, and they've been remodeling it. So there was a whole empty room with, like, wooden floors. We wore our socks, ate pizza, drank this drink called Kenny Loggins, which is amazing. We had it at the Double Wide in Dallas when I played there once. I was like, hey, what's the Kenny Loggins? That's what I said to the bartender. Hey, what's the Kenny Loggins? And the guy looked at me, and he made this very serious face, and he goes, dude, that's a highway to the danger zone. And let me tell you what it is. It's Yoo-hoo chocolate drink and triple espresso vodka. I'm telling you, put that stuff over ice. It is an insane way to get your yayas. If you like one drink, if your person likes six drinks, maybe that's not your drink. One, maybe two Kenny Loggins. Listen, I've taken the highway to the danger zone. I've had a total of three one night, and that really put me under. Last night, I had a couple of regular drinks, and then I had a Kenny Loggins at the end, kind of to ease off the night as like a dessert drink, which is fantastic. Now, I am heading to Houston. It is Saturday, and I'm sorry this is coming out a day late, but this isn't going to matter by Monday. So if you're listening to this the day it comes out, I'm sorry. Oh, I want to let you guys know that I'm playing on Tuesday, October 28th, at the Volstead for a celebration and anniversary of the Volstead Act, which I should probably look it up. I knew what that was at one point, but I don't know what it is. Tweet at me. Let me know what it is. My friend Nathan Harlan, who used to be in Endosheen with me, will also be on the bill, and there's some DJs and stuff, so it's going to be a good time. Come on down to the Volstead. I believe I play at about 8:30 or 8:45. Come on down. Doing a set. Solo. All right. So, my conversation with Chris Frenchie Smith is coming up. You guys sit down and enjoy it. I'm going to drive to Houston and play some crazy Halloween party tonight. So, enjoy my conversation with Chris Frenchie Smith, my dear friend for 23 years. We used to work at Whole Foods together. Then he got in 16 Deluxe. I got him Mr. Rocket Baby. We remain pals, you know, to this day. And we get together now I think, every once in a while and talk on these microphones. And so I think we're going to, next year, you know, we'll have Chris come back. He's a fantastic dude. All right. I hope you're having a great weekend. I hope that you enjoy How Did I Get Here. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, like our Facebook page. And if you want to really get involved, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I am at Johnny Gowdy. All right. Let's talk to Chris Frenchie Smith. Let's get down. Check this out. I was listening to the Frenchie Smith Records SoundCloud page.
I need to visit that.
It's good, man. There's a lot of songs on there. It's like listening to a long record. And man, it's great. You make great sounding records. You really do. They're great, and there's an energy in them that...
I wish I could take credit for all of that.
Yeah, because...
I had a kind of a revelation kind of late in the game to realize what your life means, but I had a revelation of really what my stake is in it, or where I belong. I got to record a band at the Bubble, and I produced it, and my engineer, Sean Raleigh, he engineered it. The group is called O Conqueror. And I met the guys through kind of, you know, in music, nothing's unusual.
Right.
But I met them in this band in particular because I had gone to the Recording Conservatory of Austin. It's a recording studio that's run by John Stinson. And so I still have like remains of Starbucks donut in my mouth. anyway, the reason I was there was to do some kind of demonstration of recording for whatever students wanted to participate, with me being their visitor and, you know, giving a lecture or whatever. And some people had gone there and done, well, like a drum clinic and,
right.
So for me, it's like, well, if I'm going to do whatever I do, it's going to be based on having a band come in and, you know, recording an entire song in a day. And so we had the boxing lesson come in, and they did a song called Eat Your Heart Out. And obviously everyone in the in the recording demonstration or whatever, all the students, there's a fellow named... some of them are students and some of them work there. It's kind of a co-op of sorts, you know. Mm-hmm. The pupil becomes a master and takes on another student. It's very organic how it all works over there. But I had stayed in contact with a guy named Justin Green who works there and has his own studio. And he has a band. He's in a band called O Conqueror. So anyway, he has his own studio. And he's affiliated with a recording school.
Okay.
So, to say the least, he has his own ability to record his music.
Right.
So, they went with the option to come over to my place and do a few tracks, which, I mean, obviously, that, because of the setup of it, that was very humbling. It's like, well, you guys can do this really well on your own, but you want to involve me in what you're doing. And Justin took some time out of his life to go in cyberspace and write me a note and post it on my Facebook page thanking me for the good experience they had. And he had said that many things, but one of the things that really resonated with me is that it made them a better band, you know.
And that's cool.
That kind of compliment is something that, you know, sustains, you know, a guy like me when, you know, maybe we're wondering if you know, just you just you're having a bad moment, and you just kind of remember those kinds of moments, and you work past it. You put some flange on a drum kit, and it's all good again.
Well, there can also be like this paternal experience, and you know, for a band when they go work with someone that is both. It's kind of like when you get to a magical relationship with like a parent or a mentor, at that point where you're almost equals. And that person's helping you up to be, like, come on, you're this close. I'm going to lift you up the rest of the way.
Sure, sure.
And that can be a great experience. It also can be really sad at the end of the recording thing. Do you get sad a lot?
I don't think so, but you know, I don't really do like emo goodbyes. I have more of like, I definitely subscribe to the. Like the rock and roll social ethic, like I'll see you when I see you, dude.
Yeah,
you know,
that's cool.
And that's cool
because it would be fucking sad. You get attached to people.
Well, and that's part of the benefits.
Yeah.
Of being able to have some kind of social networking on a personal basis, like tell people jokes, really inappropriate jokes, or just you find a picture of someone. You know, doing some really bad mouth breathing and sweating on stage and experiencing massive hair loss. And that's, and I'm tagged that it's me, you know, from a guitar player I produced. Like, that's priceless. But the, you know, once Justin had said those words to me, the revelation that I had was, you know, I'm at best just an extension of the band's best ideas.
Yeah.
And it was a very big and small feeling. But, you know, it just, I try to keep my stake in it kind of in check. And really, my skill set, or whatever you would call it, is absolutely based on what artists are already doing with their... what they're naturally occurring good ideas.
You come in and fill in the cracks and try and help them get to be the bridge to the next place, right?
Sure.
Is that a good analogy?
And maybe just ask them questions that they would ask themselves if they had the advantage of touring that material for 5 or 6 years okay, you know, just, but some objectivity, but just it's obviously such a simple revelation, and why didn't I have it before? And maybe I have, but it was pretty overwhelming. And it's, you know, it was something that I was thinking about yesterday. So it's like, at best, I'm a participant, and you know, some kind of sonic referee and mirror of what bands are doing songwriting-wise, and ask them the right questions and encouraging them. So if you liked what you heard on that SoundCloud page,
yeah,
it's probably because those bands are really cool.
Yeah.
And whatever flag I'm flying, we kind of found each other in the wild. And you know, I, for whatever reason, I don't tend to attract bands that, even if it's a, you know, if it's a pop track or it, you know, it has some kind of broadcast radio thing down the road.
Yeah.
You know, the working in small portions or aiming low or not taking chances. That's, you know, most musicians I work with are luckily perceive that I'm into that kind of thing, and so they've already done a lot of the thinking for both of us, like in Casablanca. So they you know, they're ready for that.
Yeah. What is it that what speaks to you when you see a band or someone sends you something? What, obviously a good song, but there seems to be an energy with a lot of the bands that you work with. There's it's palpable. When you listen to the track, you feel the energy of the band. Is that something that you look for?
You know, the creative process on my end is something that I'm a little shy to look in the eye. If something just kind of works, I try to move past it and not be too cerebral about
okay.
it. But this similar choreography. If we were in a band and we were 22. And I knew you when you were 22.
Yeah.
And you look the same. I mean, you were really good then. Like, you knew
Thanks.
How to do harmonies that were like Robin Zander.
Thanks,
and
man.
Like, man, like, how does he do that? You know, but when you're in a rehearsal room and some kind of musical thing works and you're playing music with your band member.
Yeah.
If a lyric works, a drum roll works, we move past it.
Yeah.
And try not to spike the football in the end zone. Like, we haven't figured out the chorus yet, but like, these elements are working together. So,
right.
You know, really celebrating things too early or overly intellectualizing them gets them further from, can get them further from just their natural, naturally occurring self-discovery.
Yeah.
And so, if there's something I'm looking for in a band, I think it's an attitude thing.
Yeah.
I might be a little reserved to work with a band that has a lot of rules. You know, and sometimes that's just how a crew works. If they kind of have, their rules of what is right and what is wrong, well, that's fine on a moral level, of course. You know, go do be who you are. We can have fundamental differences. I can be an Amish priest, and you can be satanic, and we can still have commonalities. We can still agree that this is a great riff.
Yeah,
but really, if I don't think the band is comfortable with having a collaborator that isn't in the band, then that's probably the fundamental thing that
okay.
makes me shy about working with them.
Right.
Or if a portion of the band would like that, but then some of the key portions of the band, like
right.
the singer, are resistant to that, then I'll still dig what they do.
Right.
And be like, all right, well,
go on.
Maybe they need to do it
their way.
Their way for whatever period of time, and
then
and we kind of meet in the middle when they've had whatever experiences they need to have to see whatever benefits could come from having a creative partnership with
right.
a producer.
I was thinking, you touched on something that I was thinking about with you. I had to drive out to Dripping Springs this morning, and on my way back, I was thinking about sort of your place in this whole scene, and just kind of in music. Like you've really risen to a great place. Like created a career for yourself that I think is really great. You make great art. You're always busy. You have a tremendous amount of output. And I always remember you as someone that didn't have rules, because I would say you and I started out as dudes that we weren't in a scene. We were guys that worked at Whole Foods, and we were just kind of like got to this town, and we were like, we didn't know where we fit in, really.
How do you tap into it?
Yeah. And I remember when in the time when I was in Mr. Rocket Baby and you were like in 16 Deluxe, the scenes that we were in were not at each other's shows. But I remember plenty of times looking to the right and seeing you against the wall there at Steamboat at our shows. Likewise, going to all of like Electric Lounge or places where, you know what I mean? Where you wouldn't find Breedlove or something. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
And I always admired that.
It was compartmentalized a little more.
Yeah, I liked that you didn't really buy into, I can only do this. I can only be here. And so you didn't have rules, and that's what I like about you.
Well, to be fair, I whatever microcosm that my band ages ago might have been hip with, I might have even felt outside of it a little bit.
Me too. And mine.
And so what kind of fraternity I was looking for was what you were doing on stage, you know, just kind of going my memories. And
yeah.
I don't know if the rules in general are as staunch. Is that the word?
I don't think they are anymore. I think that kind of peaked in the early 2000s with like the indie rock people.
Yeah. And you know, a band now can say, hey, come over here and vote for us for single of the day. You know, check us out on this blog where our video is up for video of the week at MTV University, or
right.
Or we're nominated to be on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Right.
Vote for us. And you can appeal to your audience or just do blanket marketing to you can saturate if that's the word.
Yeah.
Where that would have been something that could have been an item of you know, that could have compromised the credibility of an artist in the 90s. That was
sure in the 90s, like people like would never have their songs in commercials.
Right.
That was like the low. Now it's the best thing that can fucking happen to you, to anyone, and mostly indie artists.
Sure.
You know what
sure.
I mean?
And it's funny because, you know, what, you know, the content, you know, the credibility of it. Well, okay, well, the song is, the lyric has some kind of romantic feel and a sense of self-discovery.
Yeah.
The chords are major key chords. It's in 4/4.
Right.
You say the word love 8 times. It's already a commercial.
Right.
But you look like you're Pavement's a roadie, so you have edge.
Right.
So just some of that's been dispelled a bit. Man, I thought Pavement used to be really cool. That Crooked Rain record.
Yeah.
I'll think about that record sometimes. And it's something that I enjoyed in its time. But I'll revisit it with how loose it is. And no one went to the record store. The 300,000 plus people never went to the record store and took the record back because the vocals were a little out of tune and the drums were like, oh.
Yeah.
It's quite cool.
Yeah,
it's
a vibe.
So maybe if there is something to tap into, something you asked earlier, you're saying the songs have energy. And
the band feels like it has energy, translates into the song. And then, you've seen so many people where you see the band and they go make a record and you're like, what the fuck happened? You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm aggressively
doesn't seem like
trying
it's happening
to push
for
that.
You.
That is something on a daily basis that I'm pushing to get the dual art forms, you know, because it used to make a lot of sense to say, well, the recording's the recording and a live show's a live show. However, and I think this hasn't happened a lot, but there was some time ago I'd made a recording with a band, and you know, they had quite an infrastructure in the group, and sometimes that's a very positive thing. And in their case, it was as well. But there was a label and a manager, and I was recording the band and doing kind of what they did, and it was coming back kind of loose.
Right.
And maybe not too dissimilar to how loose Pavement was.
Right.
And by the time I started getting some feedback from the investors and really the people that were the owners of this recording, they wanted a lot tighter. They knew a lot of words, like, can you change the entire tempo by this many beats per minute? Like, wow, this is a new world. Can you tune the vocals? Like, you know, just being asked questions for the first time. And this is some years ago. And being the people pleaser guy that I thought I was supposed to be, and I like being liked, you know. I'm like, okay, well, this band needs to sustain this relationship, and you know, there's some goals with these recordings. Anyway, the recording ended up sounding fantastic. It actually is a bizarre hybrid of feeling organic and being heavily, heavily produced,
doctored.
A little bit like that, yeah. But they're cool songs, and to me the songs were still the main thing you felt. And then the recording started attracting attention for bigger labels to pick the band up, and something that's quite unusual now, which is labels flying to a city to hear and see a band, see a show, and go, let's pull the trigger on this, let's do this.
Yeah.
And the band's live show was so dissimilar, or so I might have said that wrong. It was so removed from the reality of the recording that
it exposed them.
Yeah, well, it exposed me.
Oh,
it exposed me that I took ambition and went into a Shakespearean place with it, and all of a sudden I'm killing my best friend to marry his wife or something. It was just, for what gain? And what did I gain from it, number one? And what did these brilliant musicians gain from it? So if it would have been a little looser, and I would have, had I lived through this experience that I'm describing, then I could maybe kind of defend the band a little better now, or describe to someone, you know, like, hey, this is one reason why you want your recording to kick ass and you want your live show to kick ass.
Right.
And that's something that I'll spend some time on with a band, is if there's a lot of amazing, like, musical discovery unearthed in a recording, like, okay, when you guys and gal go rehearse this stuff, like, please listen to your recordings.
Yeah.
Play the tune, listen to the recording, play the tune, because really just ages ago, you know, I was, maybe when I was in a band, I was perfectly happy with a recording was a recording, and the live show was a live show. And, well, anything goes, you know, I'm going to have a couple of beers and it's crazy.
Right. Well, with a band like 16 Deluxe, didn't you guys, I mean, wasn't there sort of a freedom once the song started to kind of...
Yeah, it could...
On a nightly basis, let it go where it's going to go?
Yeah, it felt definitely... Like that. It could be pretty loose. But, you know, there were song structures there, even though it... You know, but some things could expand and kind of reduce. But there was definitely some choreography there. But the there's some things that as a musician, there's some things that people can never take away from you. And if you can write a great song and you can record a great song, perform it live and in the studio, no matter what your external goals, our external goals are, well, it'd be really neat if we could be on this label and tour with this kind of band. Well, that's cool. Those are all big what ifs.
Right.
But no one could ever take away from you that you're truly excellent at what you do.
Yeah.
And not in a big, like, spike the football in the end zone kind of way, or in your face Flanders, you know, boastful way.
Yeah.
But just the sense of being and belonging through the hard times, the good times, at the core of our being, that we're really, you know, the real thing.
Right.
And everything else is a little bit of a gamble. So, but I do push to have as much live energy
good
in a recording as I can.
Well, I'm glad that you bring that up, because I was just reading yesterday. I was reading this article about U2 and the new Rolling Stone. And from what I'm now, over the last few years, I think the curtain has kind of come back as to what their record making process is and how it is like really overly. I mean, to the point where they make fun of themselves, you know, I mean, they're saying it too. It's overwrought. It's completely insane. The amount of, you know, shit they do to everything, and how a song, you know, up until it's on the rack, is still being worked on, you know, or on the rack in your inbox. But another thing is that they released that album, and they put it in people's iTunes, and then there was this gigantic backlash. But to me, I like U2. I would like to hear their album. The fact that they gave it to me for free, I was like, wow, that's really cool. But somebody in this climate, in this day and age, as we're now, everyone's forging new ground, because it seems like all of a sudden the playing field has no map, and now we're making new roads. And so they are in a position where they can affect everyone,
right?
You know, on a level. And so they tried it. And some people got pissed off, and then another kind of like, oh, sorry, you know, we're just trying to, you know. And so, sorry, with that, like, in the business, like, how do you view something like that? Like, wow, that's great that they tried something. Because that's how I looked at it. Like, somebody's got to do it.
Well, I'm gonna do this. Just, I'm going to fly with you on this.
Okay.
Let's look at U2. And let's look at Foo Fighters,
right?
As two giant musical entities, and each party, at their core, wants to entertain you.
Yes.
So, I believe that wholeheartedly. And or they wouldn't still be alive.
Right.
All of those musicians have seen such levels of like rock.
Yeah.
That something besides big bucks and all that boring stuff sustains them.
Right.
They're masters of creation.
Yeah.
So U2 goes down the route that you explained, and creates a unique partnership with iTunes. That's their business, right? And then all of a sudden the music is in your phone. Which my fear is that the public at large, and hopefully your public, how many people are listening to this?
A couple of thousand.
Okay,
it's at like 3,000.
Okay,
1,
so I'm going to say that the 3,000 people that listen to this podcast are wild music lovers and really looking for entertainment in all cracks of the universe.
Right.
And this audience is not subject to what I'm about to say.
Okay.
The public that doesn't worship music and look for and just study it and live in it and own it and go to shows and just think about music in such an anthropology and kind of lifestyle way.
Right.
And that public doesn't need any more. We don't need to add fuel to the fire for that public, for them to have an opinion that masters should be free.
Right.
And masters in this is singles, recordings, anything that replicates intellectual property of one recording artist or a collective known as a group. So when U2 does that, it's like, hey, U2 gave us this record. And that's kind of what most people think.
Yeah.
Well, U2 are a great rock band. They're also trying new things. I get it. And they have to try things in boardrooms, on stage, and they have to reinvent what they do. And everything to them, I'm going to imagine, is an adventure. And it always has been. So why would they dream small now? I get it. I get it. You know, so it's not a big judgment on them, but my fear is that artist doing that kind of deal is like, all right, the Santa Claus of rock and roll gave us this record. And then, so it can pervert reality a little bit, that masters don't retain value and you should pay for recordings. And, you know, maybe that's my paranoia, or maybe that's a real issue. On the other side of it, there's the Foo Fighters, and they are doing soul searching on how can we get people to be excited about us putting out like a new record and doing Foo Fighters things.
Because that seems to be like, I don't think that thought, that sort of thought was popular before the last 10 years of like constantly trying to figure out how you're going to stay relevant.
Sure. And
I think it happens on all levels. I don't know if I'm getting older, and so I think about it more now, because you don't, as a young person, you feel like you're relevant. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then as you get older, you realize, like, oh, you might not be. But it seems like even young people now are like, how's anyone going to care about what I'm going to do?
Sure.
So, yeah, I'm sorry, but go ahead with your Foo Fighters thing.
Well, so you have two groups, and right. they're both playing. They have a natural cycle to turn on the public to new material and to get everybody excited about tours.
Right.
That's what happens with an album cycle. Yeah. Here's an album. Here's a single, it's on the radio, it's kind of a commercial to the record, and then come see us play live, and we'll play new songs, we'll play songs that you've loved.
Right.
That's the game. Buy a t-shirt, whatever. Well, U2 tried a new path on that.
Right.
And, you know, the verdict is still out, whether that's what they needed to do or not do. However, it's their freedom to do that. And in a weird way, it's punk as hell that they did it. And so
it's punk, but they got a lot of money from iTunes. It's kind of punk.
So
it's like big business punk.
It's big business punk. And however, they paid the dues to be in that kind of leverage, have that leverage.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And that's something that, I am really not happy for me personally to put my nuts in the face of a band like that that's paid their dues.
Yeah.
I know where I'm at the food chain, and those guys
have
wrung this planet dry kicking the shit out of it.
Yeah.
So if that's what they need to do, that's what they need to do.
Yeah.
On the other side of it, maybe the Foo Fighters have the same goals. Okay, we have some songs, and we're going to be doing touring. How do we do some stuff that gets people excited about coming to the show next time?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just that simple, what people are thinking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are some cool musical ideas we haven't done before? And so for Foo Fighters to have Dave Grohl as their front man, who's a tremendous ambassador to rock and rock and roll curator to go into television, HBO, and create a somewhat of a documentary reality TV show. Hey, we're in the studio. We're in the city. The city has done this historically. This is the stuff that we like about it. And now you're in the recording studio with us, and we're just cussing at each other. And we've probably had about 8 beers off camera. And now we're going to play live together over the track. And bam, it's done.
But you're also going to get to see like him have these conversations and then turn around and turn those conversations into lyrics.
Yeah.
To me was really moving. It was like,
yeah, it's so cool.
Yeah.
But the intent is not too dissimilar to where U2 are coming from.
No. So it's a new world. There's a new thing, and they've got to find a way to how are you going to get excited about the whatever, like 9th Foo Fighters album. in a world that's moving so fast with so much shit coming at you.
And for me, I am just personally as a consumer, because I do buy music.
Yeah.
And a lot of it. I personally was more entertained by the Foo Fighters approach.
Oh yeah.
And and that was more engaging to me. I gravitated to it. I'm talking about it now with great esteem.
Yeah.
And I'll always love Octoon Baby by U2. I'll always love it.
Me too.
I'll always love the visual I have of Daniel Lanois, I think, getting a Grammy for the record, and Joni Mitchell handing it to him, and him being maybe kind of smashed and grabbing Joni Mitchell's ass on TV.
That's funny.
And it's just like, yeah, that's rock.
Yeah.
That's how rock they were.
Yeah.
So they can never undo that memory.
No.
And rock is dangerous. And those guys are definitely like,
yeah.
It's funny. Like U2, like, you know, Slayer is so much more hardcore than U2. Or like, I would be very frightened at a U2 versus Slayer party off.
Yeah.
I'd be very frightened to know the results of that.
Yeah.
And I don't think I don't think that people going to an Ozfest are really going to know which corner to be in.
Right. No, that's true. That's true. So you say you buy a lot of music. How do you do it?
Oh, iTunes.
Like you buy,
iTunes. And I'll take chances. You know, I'll buy a track. You know, it's just anything kind of hits me. If I've gone to a band's SoundCloud and clicked on a track more than twice,
you'll buy.
Then I'm just like, okay, that there's something about it. I want to hear this again sometime while I'm mowing the yard or cleaning dust off my fan blades and the ceiling fan blades in the house, or
right,
taking a long drive.
So you don't do any streaming services?
No, I don't. I subscribe to it, and then my gal listens to it around the house, and she is thoroughly entertained with it. It fundamentally, I just don't connect with it. It's in a similar way.
Tell me how you don't connect with it. Like, on what level?
Well, there's the guy, I believe his name is Matthew Weiner. He's the creator of Mad Men. I could be saying his name wrong. Yeah. And he was on.
No, that is the right way.
Okay, he obviously is brilliant, and I love his work. He was on NPR doing an interview, and he said something that I was driving my car and I almost crashed. You know, it's not that big a deal, but it really floored me. He has kids that were, some of his kids were born in the early 2000s, and he was asking them, talking to them about what television they consume, and evidently his children that are maximum 12 years old.
Right.
Really dig Columbo from the 70s. So this is like the Madman and Sopranos writer.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Looking at what his kids consume, like, you like Columbo? And that wasn't the real kicker here. The real deal was that it's on Netflix, and that's how they're tuning into it. And they go, well, yeah, it's on the TV. And to them, Netflix is the TV.
Yeah.
And so
TV is what they want to watch when they want to watch it, as much of it as they want to watch.
It's like, actually, you're tapping into the internet, and you're going onto this giant server known as God and watching Columbo. Like,
yeah.
You're not watching TV.
Yeah.
You know, you would have missed it. And anyway, but to them, it's just, it's all TV. It's just a blanket thing. It's like, whether it's on cable or you switch the button and it goes to streaming.
So what about that floored you? I think I heard that same. Was it Terry Gross?
I think so, yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, it's TV to me is you're watching something on cable. And then if you're still watching television and you go to stream something or watch YouTube, I'm extremely astute to the fact that I have left cable and now I'm on the internet.
Yeah. Like yeah, because we come from a different time.
You know?
Yeah.
And so streaming music and listening to something online on Sirius Satellite or XM or Bob FM, whatever, for whatever reason, I can listen to a radio station, but just streaming some kind of podcast, or it's not even a podcast. I'll go listen to interviews, but I don't really stream like Pandora or
Spotify
or Spotify and check out people's playlists. It's just I don't
check out people's places, but I just recently got on Spotify. Like I had fought that whole sort of thing for a long time, and then in some of my conversations with people, I was like, you know, it's not like everything's gonna go back to the way that we liked it.
Oh sure, you know what I mean? And no, I have a membership.
Yeah. I know, you said that. So it's
in my house or it's with my devices, and I just don't tap into it.
Yeah. And I mean, another thing is I feel like I view it differently because I've never made a living off of my songs out there making my money. I always made a living playing.
Sure.
So, like the way Tony Scalzo looks at Spotify is completely different than the way I do, you know, because every time he sees it, it's taking money out of his kid's mouth. Or food out of his kid's mouth. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But when I decided to get on it, and I just kind of checked it out a little bit for free for a month, and then I went ahead and paid for it, I lost like a week of like all my free time was consumed by building this playlist. Like, and I found... good and bad, because here I am paying $7.99, and I don't know how much fucking music I've got in my thing. But at the same time, there's music that I'd heard about that I never had the money to just go buy a bunch of that album, but now I've got like every Esquivel album. You know what I mean?
And
things like that. Like, so as the fan in me was freaking out, but the whole time I was doing it, I was like, God, look at all this shit I'm getting that I can listen to at any time on my Kindle, on my computer, on my television, or on my phone.
I mean, it was so daunting when people, you know, as young musicians, and let's say it's early 90s, and you and I are both playing in separate bands, and someone goes, have you heard this record?
Yeah.
And it's... That's on 4AD. You're like, no, that's import. Have you heard this record? It's on Wax Trax. Like, whoa, okay, well, that if you drive to that place, they have those imports. This is on Rough Trade.
Yeah.
And exactly. It's out of print. Like, whoa. I mean, just to buy music, and it certainly had value, but just the... I just remember people asking me, like, do you know about this band, The Jazz Butcher? Do you know about... I'm like, no, I don't. You know, do you, like, I know Echo and the Bunnymen, and, you know, but, like, there was just so much music even then, and the only way to really, to consume it or to hear it was just, like, to spend thousands of dollars a month, and there were those rare cases of people that just had entire houses of vinyl, right? And
yeah.
You go to their house, like, hopefully he's having a party again, because, man, last time I went there, and getting those people to make you a cassette, a mixtape, and you're like, wow, this thing is so great. And then you lose the ID,
jacket,
you have and you're like, oh my god, what is this? So, I mean, on the manic discovery side of it, like, oh my god, this stuff is so good. That's overwhelmingly positive. So I think that's great, because my flashback to making minimum wage, working a job, and, you know, not that my money went entirely into partying on 6th Street every night. It went into guitar pedals, and I got to get this new guitar amp. And if we save up, we can go into this 8-track reel-to-reel studio. Like,
Yeah.
Why? There's no audience for us. But we're building it. We're entrepreneurs. Pass that joint, you know. Yeah. So, but then, you know, it's really how the, you know, it's how the public takes the esteem they have for a track or an artist and, you know, and takes notice of, yeah. Okay, well, I keep coming back to this, my playlist, I keep coming back to this track.
Right.
Wow, it's by this band. Are they still together? Do they tour? Like, yeah, it looks like they are. So participate in their, you know, it's like a football team, right? You love this football team.
And you follow them.
You follow them. Yeah. And in general, you know, sometimes a football team doesn't happen for a football team, but with a rock band or whatever style of band, if we're not sustained, you know, even, you know, partnerships with record labels can kind of go away quite fast if the public doesn't kind of stand up for, and if they truly love it, like there's like hundreds of thousands of people streaming a track, then okay, let's corral.
So you're not threatened by it.
No,
you have a different way that you do your listening, and but you're not like, oh, Spotify and Pandora are gonna kill the world.
Oh no, I
selling the bubble.
No, my thing is if people, whatever your means to discover a track is, if you keep coming back to it, you keep spinning it, you keep putting it in a playlist, it's in some kind of virtual docket, then take note of what you like. And as much as we can easily spend $10 a day at Starbucks, just have a Starbucks free day, like just don't even hit Starbucks, and put $10 into those things that you kept going back to. Just buy that record. You know, frankly, we really need more of just that kind of resolution to the outlets. Okay, I hear the stuff. Now I have a vote. I'm getting behind this thing. Let's do that. And it's not a knee-jerk reaction. You've already been consuming it. So just go in, invest.
That's a great way to look at it. Hopefully people do that. I mean, I think there are people like us that are aware of music people and that they need to get paid for what they do. I mean, I buy a lot of music. I've not bought as much since I've been listening to Spotify.
Well, the music is still this thing that lives outside of us that we all gravitate to. Oh, so many people, the big pleasure payoff of our days, music. And it touches all walks of life, every race, every gender, every country, every religion. There is a jam that will jump into one of our heads, and we'll be at a pivotal place in a day. Am I having a good day, or am I kind of starting to slip into it? So this is kind of a crap day. We hear a jam. No, this is an awesome day. And it is, but outside of, you know, religion, sports, and love for country and music, you know, there really aren't many other things in the world. And music is right there. And you know, we're fascinated with the human form. We go to see films, and that's quite expensive. When we can go to the park and see people for free, and it's a little creepy, you're looking at people, but it's free.
Yeah.
You know, then we went to work all day. We talked to humans. We looked at humans, and then we're on YouTube at night looking at humans again. Yeah, So we're obsessed with the human form. We're obsessed with the
experience,
the human experience. Yeah. We're obsessed with the sound of our mouth. Listen to me talking so much rubbish here. However, and then music has the human essence with movement and melody. And then there's other intangible kind of triggers, right? You know, in neurons, we smell things. It's like you hear a lyric and all of a sudden you almost tear up. You're like, what the hell's happening, man? Yeah, I'm a grown ass man driving down the street and I'm crying here. Shut up, Bono. Of course she still loves you. You're awesome.
I had that moment. I was listening to Fresh Air and I was running and they had, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on her name, but the girl from 20 Feet from Stardom that sang on that fucking Rolling Stone song. Children, it's just a shot away. It's just a shot away.
That was a backing vocalist.
Right. And she told her story about being woken up in the middle of the night and going and doing that session and being pregnant. And then they played the isolated track of her doing it.
Wow.
And when they did, it's making the hair on my arm stand up. I was running on the trail and I stopped and I was like, it took the air out of my lungs and it made me start like not just kind of tearing up, but like crying. Like it, the fact that that still happens to me and I'm in my 40s.
That's a sustainable.
That is fucking magic, dude. And that like when it was happening, I was like, I mean, and then you're like, fuck, I'm part of this family. I don't know if I do that to people, but I'm part of this family that stirs emotion in people.
Yeah,
that's fucking awesome.
Let's talk about the thing you just mentioned. It's a heightened experience.
Yeah,
and it's a sustainable experience. It has massive points of reference. There's the isolated track. There's the source of the track. There's right. the backstory of all
of
it.
Yeah.
And it's the human experience.
Yeah.
It's so personal. Now, obviously, you're hearing about that because that song hit. It hit. You know, it took over the world, and it has like this massive life of its own.
Huge life.
And every time I hear that track, I have bizarre just visions of like helicopters landing to pick me up in Vietnam. Like, I mean, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
But there's nothing much more important than music. I mean, we go to happy hour, right? It's like, okay, we're all out of work from this hour to this hour. We're going to have happy hour.
Yeah.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Well, does the happiness stop?
Yeah,
at 7?
Yeah,
at 7. Like, and it doesn't begin. Like, what are you telling me how I feel? What are you marketing to me? And so it's superficial things that hit us daily.
Yeah,
like, hey, you got to wake up. Here's some coffee. Here, now it's time to be happy.
Yeah,
or we can even go deeper into that. But the sustainable buzz of music is no joke.
No.
And so, I mean, it's obviously affected our lives and we're believers.
Yeah.
You know, and,
we're like junkies,
but at the public at large,
yeah,
that gets marketed to like, here's happy hour.
Yeah.
Here's your happy meal. Here's your,
yeah,
you know, whatever, pumpkin spice latte, just whatever we're told on a daily basis. Just please recognize the sustainable buzz and real emotion of what music means to you as a us.
Yeah.
And do some soul searching on how to get behind that.
Yeah.
And be a player in it. There's more than just calling up American Idol and voting for someone. We vote when we find a little band. A little band that could.
Yeah, that's what you said last time. You said when you go buy a record, you're casting your vote. Like you're behind this thing, and you should.
And I don't know how to say it any other way, but it obviously in my way, I'm voting as well, and there's much more that makes me tick than the dollar figure behind the production of a record.
Yeah.
If my existence was based on that, then I'd be seeing you at happy hour.
Right.
Okay, well, that should have been That's it. It's a wrap, boys. It's 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
We worked for 5 hours. Well, I haven't really warmed up yet. Well, we'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And money's just a necessary ingredient to the whole thing, but it's certainly not the entire basis of it. There's something much more bizarre and savage and reaching that drives me.
Good. That's what makes, I'm glad that we had this conversation. Hey, what do you?
I'm very confused by it. Should we take a break and have
Well, no, I think we've reached the end. Well, I was going to ask you, what are you working on? And then we'll go smoke. What are you working on? What's going on? Anything that you want to talk about that you're proud of?
Well, in no particular order.
Okay.
I mean, one thing that has been years in the making is I am a co-manager.
Yes.
For a group called Purple.
Yes, who I really liked a lot on the SoundCloud.
So I manage them with my manager, and his name is Sandy Robertson, and the company's called World's End. And Sandy and I have partnered up on getting behind this band over the last 3 years. And they've been touring America. They've probably... In the last 2.5 years, I mean, they must have done like 4 tours a year of America. And now, and then Sandy put the Wave 1 of their debut album out in America. So it was available online and very available while they were touring the United States. So people love the band. Take a little bit of the band home with you. Here's a 12-inch vinyl.
Yeah.
And here's a CD. But it's really, you know, a brand new group to the world, and quite a young band. You know, when I met them, the drummer singer was maybe 19. So, you know, everybody's like, the old dude was like 22, you know. So now they're 22 and 25 and just mad for this stuff and just tremendous 3-piece rock band. And we just licensed their record to a label called Pious, mm-hmm. out of England, and now they're currently on tour with a band called The Subways. And
I've heard of them.
So they're just, I mean, main support for them. And then they're venturing into Europe. The record comes out in Europe. It's called 409 by the band Purple. It comes out in Europe November 11th, and then late January in the United States. And it just... As far as like things that I'm proud of,
yeah.
I mean, they came over to my house in the middle of the night. I was having a party. Maybe my girlfriend was having a party, and I was just the person buying extra toilet paper and paper towels and keeping people from having this ancient doorknob locking them in the bathroom. That was my job.
Yeah.
But later, at the end of the night, I was kind of just looking around, like, oh, it was kind of neat. It was like. Like 5 or 6 shows kind of ended, and the musicians of those shows just wound up at our place. And like, oh, who are these guys? You know, not in an ugly way, like, get out of here. I'm like, hey, what are you guys doing? Like, we're in a rock band. We just played the Dirty Dog and won the Battle of the Bands contest. Like, that is amazing. And I was producing the Toadies the next morning at, you know, pretty early, probably like 9 or 10 a.m.
Wow.
And so that's aggressive for me. So I go, well, do you have any music on you? They're, yeah, we've got this CD that we recorded in some dude's office. You know, like I guess the guy, their friend's father had this commercial warehouse in Beaumont, Texas. And then at night, he would do recordings in it. It's just awesome. I love the recording. So I called them. I went to bed at 4:30. I got up at 8, and I called them first thing I got up because I was listening to the CD in the car.
Wow.
Like, this is awesome. And so we started a creative relationship at that point. So, but Sandy, as my mentor, being kind of the head of business and the band, and then me being involved in a portion of that, but you know, heavy on creative, and to try new things where... I think in the past I've been disappointed when a group and myself would have made some kind of recording, and I felt the parties working with the band didn't try hard enough, or they didn't try to communicate with the band in a language that they could understand. You know, it's like, it might have been just kind of icy cold. Like, well, I sent all of you the email, and it's very literal what I said.
Right.
Screw yourselves that you need to have a phone call as a follow-up. Yeah. Or tacos as a follow-up.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to turn... The band means enough to me that I just didn't want to turn them loose into the wild. And like, all right, well, this band means everything to me, so... What am I going to do about it besides just have an opinion that a manager or a label wouldn't do what I think should happen? But so it's early stages, but you know, they to have a band signed to an international label, and for them to have label mates like Interpol and Enter Shikari and the Pixies, I mean,
that's
just
amazing. Yeah,
it's I'm really proud of it, and it's a relatively low key part of my existence. I don't know if people know that I'm managing, and that's fine, because I don't really need to do that on every project. You know, my true trade is to help people do the recording, but for whatever reason, that band,
this one, you saw something that you could help with,
and just we had the same sense of humor.
Yeah,
and part of it is really personal. Hannah Brewer is the singer, and she plays drums, so female singer, musician, and Taylor, the guitarist. There was just something about them that I saw a glimpse of my past.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I can, no matter what happens, I can always tell them the truth. Yeah. So if that's my ethos, I can manage this.
Yeah.
And obviously having Sandy involved, someone that is like a business partner of mine and mentor, like he was the person that I needed to bring in.
Yeah.
as far as most recently, like I just did a local band called O Conqueror.
Yeah.
We did 3 tracks, record and mix 4 days. It's done. I love it.
Awesome. Is it out?
Not yet.
Okay.
But it will be.
I think I've had them on the show. That's how many shows I've done where ever since you said it, I'm like, did I have them on, or did I go see them, or what? I got to go back and look.
Well, then, there's something that I've been working on for the last month, and it took a break and we started up again, is a fellow named Ollie Thompson. Mm-hmm. And he is 26 now, but when he was 15, he was kind of known as a very gifted guitarist in England, a child prodigy of sorts, you know, but not like shredder, but just, he just had a thing. And Brian Ferry caught wind of him, and at 15, he left school and joined Brian Ferry's band. And so he played in Brian Ferry's band and Roxy Music for the last 9 years.
Wow.
And we'd become friends through an American contact of his, Jeff Wooding, that I did A&R at Epic for some time, and has some Austin ties. So it's very organic, kind of natural social thing there.
Yeah.
And he had introduced me to Ollie some years back when he had a different side group while still playing with Brian and Roxy Music. And I went to England, spent some time with him. We worked on some songs. That particular band wasn't the band that he needed to do the thing with. So we stayed in contact, but I was just kind of like, man, this guy's really kick ass. What are we going to do? So I just didn't punish him, but I always stayed in contact.
That's good.
And, you know, it's his life. So yeah. I think he realized that he's a solo artist. And instead of having to corral a band, it's like, actually, I'm not a big dick. I'm just a solo artist.
Yeah.
Like Sheryl Crow came up with the same concept. Okay, I've done it. I've played with these people. I've done this. all right, I've learned a lot behind the scenes. This is what I want to do, and this is why I want to do it, and I'm dead centered on it. Yeah. So he's that kind of guy. So we've been recording. I mean, this is unheard of. Even if you're signed to a giant label, we've probably spent about 22 days working on tracking on 5 songs.
Wow.
So it's, I mean, something that, you know, something that obviously I believe in.
Yeah.
And this guy could record with anyone in England, you know, he could.
Are you doing it over there? Or is he? Been
oh, he's here right okay. now.
Oh, great.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Brian has a studio, like he could.
Right.
I mean, you know, he's one of them. He could call up Johnny Marr, like, hey, what you got any ideas about doing a little song? You know, yeah. Like, he's one of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, but he wanted to be a crazy Texas British cowboy. It's like he wanted to come here and ride horses and live in a teepee and use power generators to operate the studio. You know, like the concept of what Texas is when you're from England. You
sure.
know? Like, well, there's the one cactus. It's actually, it was planted there. We bought it at Home Depot. Oh, I thought there'd be more of those. But yeah, I mean, you know, and I think the end game is for him to come back with you know, British musicians and play around for South by Southwest and hang out for a while.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, very well, you know, I could be doing more of what I described with Purple with him.
Yeah.
You know, to have that kind of investment in it emotionally and sonically and just time-wise.
Yeah.
And so so essentially, you know, I would say that I'm in early stages of kind of reinventing what I do. You know, I mean, I certainly take great pleasure in recording and mixing 3 songs in 4 days, and like the buzz of that, and listening back to the music, going, "Wow, 4 days ago there was nothing, and now we have this," and you just hit a button, and then you can airdrop it with this other button. Oh, that's so neat, and just. And hear it in the car, and like, that is a tremendous creative buzz.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a lot of bands have a manager, they have a label, or they're self-managed, and rightfully so. But there's some things that maybe I'm venturing into more of an A&R producer, and just building what the band and I think fits as a number one song on the radio station in our minds.
Yeah. That's great. That's the way it should be, man.
But but there's no better time. Excuse my French. There's no better time to fuck some shit up on a recording than right now.
Yeah.
The radio system is a little challenged, and the major label system is a little challenged. So trying to placate to some kind of formula of what is hip right now, by the time you finish it, it's a light year ago.
Yeah.
Just kick the shit out of what you're doing, put some heart into it, and if it sounds a little cranky and busting out the seams, it might sound real, and it might be a theme to someone's mood. And there's a handful of bands that really tap into that. Arctic Monkeys tap into that. Black Keys, tap into it. You know, I think Arctic Monkeys really do, though, in some weird way. There's something a little bit unfinished about the recordings I really respect.
Yeah, totally.
Hopefully Trail of Dead do.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of raw edges.
How are they
doing?
What's going on with those guys?
Record coming out. It's called 9.
Yeah.
That comes out in, I guess a month in the United States.
Okay.
And that was recorded.
Are they going to tour and stuff?
They're going to be in Austin, Texas.
When?
October 30th. I can't wait to see the marquee. They're going to need a new marquee at the Belmont. And you will know us by the Trail of Dead. I love you, but I've chosen darkness. Magnet School. And it's Brandon Tucker's band is the first band on the bill.
Oh, awesome.
He's a bass player in Magnet School.
Awesome. Oh, I ran into him at when the Pecan Street Festival was going on.
Okay.
I was walking down there and I ran into him and his lady. And I was like, oh, I was just talking about you with Frenchie. Only, whoa, I just broke this chair. Okay, I guess we got to leave this here now.
Okay.
My chair is broken. Thank Sound you effect. So much, Frenchie, for doing the show again. And people can find out about Frenchie Smith Records by just looking it up on online.
And maybe a more, yeah, something like that. It just, we're definitely a little more active on the Facebook side of it, actually.
It seems like that's where everything
that's kinda
is
where we're at.
Gone.
And as far as contacting me, I do work at a studio called The Bubble. So we're bubblerecording.com. That's Bubble where we're at.
.com.
And for more inquiries about Purple coming to play your
bar mitzvah.
Your bar mitzvah and your what are the kind of your wedding, your Concerts. Divorce party, your annual nose hair trimming festival, you know, shoot us a Frenchie@worldsend.com. Shoot us an email about your interest in Purple. But keep an eye on them. That record is called 409. And it's coming out on Pius in the United States and worldwide. And just keep an ear out on them. They're gonna be touring the globe for the next year plus. And it's everything exciting about everything I've lived through in my whole life is in that band.
Well, it shows, man. It sounds great.
Okay. Thanks for having me. How did I get here? Here.
Yes, my old pal Chris Frenchie Smith making his second appearance on the show. What a great guy. He's very excited about that band Purple. I'm going to play a song by Purple after I do this outro, so you can stick around and hear the band Purple that he is so excited to be co-managing and working with, producing, and his label, Frenchie Smith Records. Amazing. What a great dude. Great accomplishments, and I love him. Sweet guy. Amazing way of expressing himself, an artful and esoteric way of talking, which I enjoy always. All right, Chris Frenchie Smith, get out there and get involved with the music that he is involved with. He did say it, man. Get out there and buy music. If you find yourself listening to something on Spotify or on Pandora or in any way going to YouTube and checking it out twice, once you check it out twice, you probably want it. So get out there and buy it because it helps the artist and it keeps this whole machine going and keeping music coming to you, okay? While you're out there on the internet checking out music, don't forget you can like our Facebook page. You'll find out what shows are coming out. You'll find out what's happening with some artists that are out there that have been on the show. Maybe you like them, like the Sphinx tour that's going on, like the Wild Adriatic tour that's coming up of Europe. Yeah, they're going to Europe. Anyway, yeah, get in there, get involved. How did I get here? It's a Facebook page. You can also follow me on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can always subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you listen to a podcast on your iPod. Or if you listen through Stitcher, you can find us on Stitcher as well. Okay? Get involved. Check out Frenchie Smith. Here's the band that he loves so much, Purple. Have an album coming out soon. Here's a song from them, Let's Get Down.
I like to party and wear a bikini.